if nobody has any food news, we'll get started. Did the Google form work for reporting your worksheet questions? Does that seem like a reasonable approach for the? Okay, yeah, I kind of liked it. I hope it works for you, and it'll give us a kind of thing to something to focus on, since this isn't exactly a science class, and I'm certainly not competent to teach science of nutrition.
Just sure. For the next time, I wasn't sure, like, if you wanted me to include or want us to include the questions in it or just put our answers down.
Either way will work for me. That's a good question, though. Yeah, I mean, a lot of people, it's easy to block copy the questions and type it in, but yeah, I'll track it either way. Okay. I'm going to glance at it. As long as you're not, you know, writing some stream of consciousness about something else, I'll probably notice that it's about carbohydrates. And so I'm not going to do a lot of grading of this. It's just going to be kind of all or nothing, probably. And I guess our deadline would be by class time. Does that make sense? Because we want to be able to talk about it in class. Okay, good. All right, well, let's do carbs last. What I did was I paired today's readings with a story about carbs from Moss's book, Salt, Sugar, Fat. And I originally had two chapters from that book in mind for the course. As you know, I wound up making chapter 11 kind of optional. So maybe I'll just give you that. I just wrote this summary based on rereading it this morning. So that, since we didn't read this chapter, let's just get the general idea together. You don't need to take any notes on this unless you find it useful to track. So chapter 11, which we won't go into as much detail as the other one, it's really a story about Kraft's effort to respond to the obesity epidemic. And initially, Kraft had a group within the company who was responding to the public outcry about obesity and saying, wow, you know, here we are producing these high-fat, high-salt, high-sugar snacks that people eat too much of. Maybe we should be publicly responsible public citizens, corporate citizens. So one of my motives in including this chapter is that Moss goes out of his way to document a really noble effort by a major corporation to make their food healthier in light of the obesity epidemic. So in the process of telling the story, you learn that Kraft had been acquired not so long before this by Philip Morris, the tobacco company, and some of the executives of Philip Morris had been through the tobacco litigation. As you know, there was a huge multi-state tobacco litigation which created how many billions of dollars in settlement to cover the tobacco industry for the period of time prior to the warnings on cigarette labels. So the idea was that that's a reparation for that. So these executives were kind of like, yeah, well, we've been through this on tobacco, so good. You guys in Kraft who are into, like, taking calories out of the food line, go for it. And so they proposed some very enlightened things. They proposed packaged nutrition labeling. Is anybody familiar with what that is? Packaged nutrition labeling? I didn't know about this until I read this chapter either. This is where you say, in light of the fact that people often snarf a whole bag of potato chips in one sitting, you might want to put on the package the total calories, because we always do serving sizes, right? That's our nutrition labeling approach. Well, as you know, people mess with the serving sizes to get the nutrients to where they want. So, and I mean, to keep the fat levels down. So if our practice is to actually just eat the whole bag, Kraft was saying, well, let's tell the consumer that there's, you know, 5,000 calories in that bag. And so do you see where I'm going with that? So they proposed these things that were even beyond what the federal government was entertaining. And they suggested reducing calories. They took out messaging on the products that involved saying to indulge, encouraging people to indulge, you know, that kind of messaging. They took out, they suggested restraint in marketing to kids. They literally removed billions of calories from products. It was kind of a funny thing to, let me just mention a couple of these, because they have billions to work with. So they took, let's see, where was that, 256, I wanted to mention a couple of the great power. Can you imagine having the power to say, you know, I'm going to take 120 billion calories out of Capri Sun? Capri Sun was one of the worst. They took out up to a trillion calories out of the food line. So that's also a testament to how much you can engineer food, right? You could say, oh, well, it's okay. You want to take a billion calories out? We can do that. the problem and where this story goes is where you probably read already. Sales tanked, and Wall Street said, "What the hell are you guys doing?" So previously we've talked about the story in relation to government regulation and government awareness of health problems and how the government and the industry interact. That was way back earlier in the term. So this was a story more about a company trying to do something and responding at sort of as a socially responsible company, and then finding out in no uncertain terms that Wall Street won't allow that. You know, so this is, if you were taking a note on this, the main significance of this chapter would be that in addition to the government regulatory industry relationship we've studied, there's also obviously, maybe now you have details for what's obvious, there's a industry financial market relationship, right? Remember how we talked about how food industry is problematic in a capitalist country because businesses are based on the idea of growth and producing more and getting people to consume more, but food might be an anomaly in that sense, because if you get people to eat a lot of food, guess what happens? They get a lot of diseases, right? So now we're kind of this chapter just adds in a dimension of the story to say that, you know, Wall Street won't tolerate publicly traded companies that don't maximize earnings on investment. And that's kind of how the system works. That's not necessarily a criticism of the whole system. But I thought that chapter added that. But as I said, I didn't feel like we had room in our reading budget for it, so I took it out of the course. Any thoughts about that? Any connections you guys can make about that? I mean, it's relevant to some of you who are thinking about going into the new food industry or going into food. Some of you come from families that have backgrounds in food. I mean, maybe some of you can connect with it. Any thoughts about that? I'm good. I mean, you didn't read the chapter, so I don't know if you necessarily have much to say about it. Okay. Well, let's shift then to, and then at the end, everybody gets fired. You know, that's kind of the way the story ends. You know, all those people that had all those noble ideas about making the product line healthier and stuff, they just all got fired. Because that's not the way it works. Okay. All right, so let's take a minute, just take 2 or 3 minutes to browse through the chapter 4 there. We actually have a visitor with us. Do you mind if I could call attention to you? Tell me your name again.
Cora.
And where are you from?
Corvallis, Oregon.
Any other Corvallis, Oregon folks? Okay. Anyway, we want to impress her with our scintillating discussion of this chapter, so take 2 or 3 minutes to page through it and remind yourself what's in it, and then I'll take you through, and I'll put these notes up too for you. And I even got you a Apple Jacks commercial to watch as part of our discussion of this chapter. Okay, so just take a couple of minutes. I'll refresh my memory and you refresh yours, okay? Dentist here. Are any of you headed to dental school? None of you? I have a student in my other class who's already in dental school. Right. All right. Ends with one, a cereal that I used to eat, Frosted Mini Wheats. Any of you eat Frosted Mini Wheats still? They're pretty good. They're pretty great, you know. So let's go ahead and. All right. This is kind of, we haven't really had a reading that takes us into the industry's approach to cereal marketing. So if you're starting some notes on this chapter, let's start with that. This chapter gives us a look at cereal marketing from the industry side. In a moment in history when cereal products were growing in demand hugely, and yet there was a public outcry about sugar and obesity. So the shock statistic for me from this chapter was the idea that in less than two decades, cereal sales go from $660 million to $4.4 billion. And this is a huge industry. And the other shock statistic to me came later in the chapter when you learn that two-thirds of the price of cereal is in the advertising. Right? So one of the things we've been doing in this class is talking about food value. How do we assess the value of food? We're doing that in terms of nutrition today with carbohydrates. But so how do you assess the value of a food product? And you know, just initially, tell me your thoughts. I mean, if you find out that you're going to get this box of cereal, which is between 30 and 60% sugar, and two-thirds of the price of it is advertising to get you to buy it, what's your initial assessment of the value of the underlying product? How are we going to make that comparison? I mean, maybe it's obvious, but how are you going to make that comparison? It's, you know, if you took all the cereal out and put it in a big bowl and you looked at it, you said, okay, what did I pay for there? What did I get? What did somebody do for me there that I couldn't do myself? Well, there are some things, right? You don't have a machine to extrude cereal, right? You can't design those cool little nests of wheat that crunch just right in your mouth when you get the sugar in there, right? And then when you get the milk in there. So, yeah, you are getting, so in one sense, you're getting value added, right? But what would you be comparing? Like, if you wanted to do an analysis of this, and you're saying, okay, how would I compare that nutritionally and price-wise to the nearest unprocessed alternative? That would be an interesting exercise. Maybe some of you who are doing your diet work would want to do that.
Well, I know one thing that the chapter talked about was how, like, once cereal became a big market, a bunch of stores made just like store brand cereal.
Right.
That was significantly cheaper because they
right.
didn't advertise. And so that was kind of like a good benchmark to say, like,
absolutely.
In reality, this is the
ah, that's
same
a real,
thing.
Very good.
It's like, I'm paying for this.
Yeah.
This is the same thing, but it's
yeah.
Like,
so you can use the Western Family Grape Nuts knockoff as a kind of comparison. And that'll get you the advertising difference, although they're not giving you all of that. They're not cutting it down by two-thirds. Good. What else could you do if you were trying to compare, do an analysis? You know, you're leaving this class, people are going to just expect you to be food experts, food gurus. Everybody's going to be calling you for advice about nutrition and diet. It's going to be horrible. But, you know, how would you make that comparison? How would you suggest analyzing that in a practical way? What would you compare a box of frosted mini wheats to? Because you can't find, like, the natural equivalent of that. That doesn't occur in nature. Right. I mean, you could compare it to whole grain cereals that you would have to make from, that you could buy in a package, but you would have to make from scratch, either by boiling the oats or by, like a store-bought natural granola would be an interesting point of comparison, right? Any other thoughts on that, about how to do that? So if any of you want to do that, I just put it out there as a suggestion. The point for your notes would be that there's good circumstantial evidence that industrial breakfast cereal is a really bad value unless you're really enjoying the advertisements. Unless you get, but you could enjoy the advertisements without eating the cereal. So really, it's if you enjoy the connection between, like if you said, wow, I could buy Bob's Red Mill oats, but Bob's Red Mill, they don't put cool ads on the TV, so I'm not going to enjoy the oats. You know, so you have to kind of make that analysis. And I think, you know, I think as attached as I have been to breakfast cereals, industrial breakfast cereals, I think I get the attachment. They're horrible values unless you're really into the form factor, unless the extruded, crunchy cereal is just such a cool experience that you couldn't imagine replacing it. Yeah.
I actually just thought of some food news related to cereal.
Ah, good. Please.
Cheerios just kind of had this
a little bit. Oh,
they started selling boxes with seeds in them, and it was like a Save the Bees campaign. So if you bought the cereal, you get the seeds.
What then seeds were they?
It was just like a bunch of different seeds.
That you were supposed to plant?
Interesting. I don't know what the technical term is for like the seed people, the seed
right.
scientists, said that like the seeds were actually, depending on where you're planting them, I think one of the seeds were like California poppies that in the South are considered really invasive to natural plants.
That
so
is a scandal, right?
The scientists were saying like this isn't actually going to help the bees because now you're invading our species with species from other states. So Cheerios like withdrew those and they stopped selling them. But then they came out saying that all the seeds that they were selling in boxes were actually approved by like whoever it is that approves those. So it just kind of left the whole thing like, you know, like, well, Cheerios is saying this, but also science is saying this. So like, which one do you believe?
Right.
Like,
so it got muddy.
But I just saw it on
It's a good thing. That's good. That's helpful. I missed that. It's a good. It also brings up the whole issue of premiums. Like we're in a culture where getting a toy in your cereal was a part. How many of you liked getting the toy? I loved it. It was great. I mean, that was kind of what was cool about getting the new box. So premiums like giving away seeds or giving you a little toy to play with. I mean, those became part of our food culture. And what you learn in the chapter is that happened. You know, partly because of social changes, labor participation by women, breakfast seemed like an easy meal to knock out, milk is subsidized. So put in your notes, we also had social changes which made industrial breakfast cereal appear to be a higher value. I mean, in the context of consumer choice, it was a value. I mean, people in you know, to the tune of almost $4 billion, people decided in the 70s and 80s that this was going to make their life better. And part of the reason they decided that was because women had the responsibility for feeding kids, and they were working more. So this raises. Remember, in our you know nascent food philosophy, we've got this kind of nexus between nutrition, satisfaction, and practicality. And so this is a good illustration of how social changes lead to perceptions of practicality that affect a perception of value between nutrition and satisfaction. So that people say, wow, for how much does a box of cereal cost? Like $5, right? For $5, you're going to get 7 breakfasts plus milk. So it seems like a good deal, right? But again, you could do an analysis of that, right? So $5, does breakfast cereal last for about a week, a box? Is that what it is? What? Something like that? How fast do you guys go through your breakfast? 2 weeks? I don't know. You don't know. Yeah. So you could calculate how long does this box last? How much milk are you putting in there? What are you paying for breakfast per month, right? And then you could do that. You could use that number to ask about value, right? So you could ask, well, is there another solution to the practicality equation? Because industrial cereal seems real practical. It seems like, wow, you just shake some out of the box. But you could compare it to other kinds of breakfast that would be just as quick, right?
Yeah, I just thought of one.
Yeah.
It goes back to like granola, and I'm thinking
right.
like granola maybe in yogurt or something.
Yeah,
like that.
Absolutely.
Instead of pouring cereal into a bowl, you
absolutely.
Pour it into yogurt and mix
right.
it.
Right. You have a much
substitution.
Absolutely. You got a much higher fiber. You have lower sugar depending upon the granola and the yogurt, and you've got more protein. You've got protein in there. So you could do the comparison, and you could ask yourself, "Wow, I've been telling myself that cereal is just the way to do breakfast because it's so quick, but." You don't know that until you're comparing it to alternatives, which may be just as quick, more nutritious, and which you may come to like just as much. So that social dimension kind of brings up practicality. I think that's interesting. So here's the central narrative of the chapter, and then let's get out any details that you notice as well. You find out in this chapter that the concern about sugar and obesity runs through this magic year that we also looked at the McGovern Committee. Remember that was the first committee that tried to set dietary guidelines and that blew up? Well, that was a congressional committee, right? McGovern Committee. Well, now we're learning a story about the FTC responding to the sugar crisis. And what just from your reading of the chapter, could some of you tell me what happened? What did the FTC try to do and how did it work out? It's about, where is this? This is about in the center of the chapter. So this is Jimmy Carter. So this is a Democrat in office. The FTC gets empowered. This is around page 76. And so there's kind of a political motive to be more activist. So what does the FTC do? Yeah.
Didn't they try to make a case that the big three, Kellogg, Post, and General Mills, were like, creating a monopoly because they controlled 85% of the cereal market in, like, the 70s.
Right.
And then it, like, they just did, like, a the big three, like, they, I don't know, the case went on for so long, they eventually dropped it in 1980.
Right. That, so the one of the cases was an effort to kind of use a antitrust argument. I forgot where that occurred in the chapter. Maybe
that was towards the beginning.
Towards the beginning? Okay. Yeah, that's good. Thanks. That's good to be reminded of. I was thinking about the FTC action, which attempted to ban all marketing of foods to children. So, right?
Didn't healthcare professionals like mail them teeth or something
To really pick up the drama of the story, it was you have to start with this guy Ira Shannon, a dental activist, probably our only one in the course, and because he couldn't get the government to measure the sugar content, so we had no information about baseline sugar content. That's a better place to pick up the story. Thanks. And so what did he find out? He found out that some of these cereals are up to 60%, 70% sugar. And then there was, a little bit later, there was a group of dentists who actually brought hundreds of decayed teeth to
children's.
Washington. What?
They were children's teeth.
Children's teeth,
yeah.
Which is pretty gross. Yeah, I know. And so the tooth decay and obesity connections is pretty straightforward. But what happened was I think is important for our thinking is what happened is that in the face of this, the FTC overreached, and the Washington Post wrote back and said, well, this is the national nanny. So what you have in our culture is a very powerful resistance, which I respect, actually. Tell me what your opinion is about this. Very, very powerful resistance to government paternalism, really. And so you have this standing argument in food policy discussions about the consumer's responsibility to make good choices. And so that's the standard industry line, is that industries produce foods, consumers buy them. So if consumers didn't buy these foods in this quantity, we wouldn't have this problem, right? So that's strong enough in our culture that was kind of the pushback. And to be fair, I'm telling you your opinion, the FTC seemed to go pretty far there. I mean, they were reaching pretty far to actually try to ban all advertising of cereals to children. But what was your experience of being advertised to as kids? What did you guys, like me, you probably watched a lot of commercials, right? Would it be too much to restrict advertising to kids for unhealthy food products? I mean, it sounds draconian, right? Wow, it's a free country. Come on, you put a product out there, it's a healthy product. I mean, it's not going to make you sick by itself.
Is it illegal in some countries, like Norway and stuff?
I don't know. That'd be a good thing to look into.
I think it is.
Are there
this environmental social class? It kind of just tends back to like individualism. So rather,
right.
You know, we blame it on the parents. But it kind of reminds me of that Fed Up documentary with like Michelle Obama. She started that
right.
Eat Good campaign, and she targeted like food deserts.
Right.
And those are structural, and people can't find good food.
Right.
And then towards the end, she ends up changing to diet and exercise because of lobbyists.
Yeah, she kind of got co-opted on that campaign, right? Yeah. Others? Yeah.
Last night I watched a documentary on four children. It's called Bite Size.
Oh.
And
right.
It's on four children who are obese.
Right.
And they're, like, one of them is sent to a fat camp.
Right.
And then she comes back and she gains 15 pounds
oh
in the
God.
First few months, just or in the first month, and it was
yeah.
just because of all the poor food that was in there. In her house, and it was just very interesting to see like all the different dynamics and the struggles for children due to limited access or limited education on
absolutely.
Nutrition.
Absolutely.
So
absolutely.
I definitely think that there should be a limit to.
Absolutely. Yeah, you're adding a good dimension to this because the consumer responsibility argument assumes that there are adults in a household who are informed and in a position to enforce good eating habits. It's notoriously difficult for adults in this culture to enforce good eating habits on their kids. There's a whole food literature about that. And so, yeah, that's a good thing to bring in here. That's a really powerful movie. That was you're thinking about the woman whose parents run like a chocolate factory?
Yeah,
chocolate,
a fudgery.
Yeah, they have a fudgery in the mall or something, or
yeah.
in Disney.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a really, Bite Size is a really powerful movie about obesity in it because it really takes you into these four homes and and you appreciate just how much is working against people being able to eat in a healthy way.
Yeah, and I like how it brings in four different cultures.
Yeah, it's
so.
Select because there's she's a white middle class
mm-hmm.
woman,
and then there's an African American school.
Right.
Like all the women want to change their bodies and change their health and overall eating.
Right. Right.
And then there's also someone.
There's the big heavy guy, the football player.
He's a heavy football player. He's 12 and is like 213 pounds or something, and has diabetes.
Right. Right. Right.
Yeah. And then the other one is from the Latino.
As I recall, a big theme in that movie is people, is representing food craving.
Mm-hmm.
Because I get the, you know, one of the things that I remember from that movie is that the kids report just how, I mean, it's almost like watching somebody addicted to a drug. They report just how much they want that,
mm-hmm.
to pound that food, and especially the sugar. Yeah. Yeah, good. It's helpful. Okay, so it's just the point I want to make for your notes is just that we have it in our culture that we're uncomfortable really letting the government be paternalistic for us. And that I understand that. It's just that that works, in this case, that works very clearly against people's health and public interest. And it assumes that adults are any better than kids at regulating their food desires. And that we don't all necessarily need help. And so, you were reminding me also that New York, right, to tax sugary drinks. Wasn't that a controversial thing when the mayor of New York wanted to, or he wanted to eliminate, like, big gulps and things like that? I can't remember if that was. Okay, so the wars themselves, really, what do they tell you? Well, let's get into that part of it a little bit. So there's a kind of what you learn from this part of the story in the last part of the chapter is that there's this really highly competitive corporate culture around cereal, and it reminded me of things I've read about Coke. Have you ever known people who worked for Coke or Pepsi? That there's an intensity. Have you heard this? There's an intensity to what it means to work for those companies.
Yeah, my buddy had an internship, and he was like forced like biweekly to watch these intense promotions.
Yeah.
And they actually taught you how to defend the product.
Right.
If you have someone come up to you and say it's unhealthy.
Yeah.
Because they say so is the cigarette.
It's kind of like marketing in alcohol and other areas where we've got a product that people want. We know that there's something somewhat unhealthy about it, but we're going to, what was that?
My bad.
Okay. But the corporate culture that grows up around it is intensely defensive. That's kind of, I think, the point that I took out of that. And so here's the key point from the cereal wars story. This is a moment where Moss says a big corporation like Kellogg changed the relationship between the food scientists and the marketers. And so the point for your notes is that this is a point in food history where we put the marketers in charge of producing the product, designing the product, and then we ask the food scientists to tailor the actual physical product to what the marketers wanted. And this comes out in a very funny way. Do you remember this odd story about how at some point Apple Cinnamon, what is that cereal again? Apple Jacks. At some point, Apple Jacks marketers actually decided that the apple was a liability. The apple was a liability in marketing because it was associated with being healthy. And so they had this cinnamon character. This might have been close to your, I don't know. I thought I'd pick this because
yes.
It's cinnamon. You remember cinnamon? So I don't know. This wasn't quite my era, but I can tell you about, I have a horrible memory, but I could probably, I'm sure you could do this better. I could tell you about serial characters that were marketed to me from a long time ago. So this may be my name's a good flashback.
Finally, I bring the taste of appleness. See ya, Stickman. Two mice keep eating my baby. Applejacks.
I am so earned this.
That's the bad apple. It's called the bad apple.
Wow.
What?
Applejack cereal with a taste of apples?
No!
Only in his dreams, because it's the taste of sweet cinnamon that's really part of a nutritious breakfast.
Huh, Apple Jacks. I want to get into them anyway.
So the apple is pathetic. Right? The apple's pathetic because he wants Apple Jacks to taste like apples. And that's stupid. You know, why would you want... I mean, Heaven forbid you would actually slice. There was a picture of an apple sliced up. Heaven forbid you would just slice apples on top of something to eat them. And so cinnamon is the cool guy, and cinnamon is just a flavor. And so this is did this cause any flashbacks for some of you? Do you have any other cereal details you remember from your childhood along these lines?
I mean, it's pretty crazy what we do. This is food. This is supposed to be breakfast. But this is also a time in our culture, even when I was young, where the purchasing power shifted to kids, right? This was a case, and this was mentioned in the chapter, that this is, in addition to women going into the workforce more, this is when kids started to be able to call the shots as far as what got bought. I'm in the wrong place. All right, so I think we're getting most of this. There was another important detail. Yeah, this is also a point where people realized that they didn't need the actual apple, they just needed the apple flavor. So the Rice Krispies story was a story about trying to reproduce Rice Krispies treats, right? Which was how many of you have had Rice Krispies treats? Right. It's a big Americana item, right? And so they couldn't do it. They couldn't get a cereal box. They couldn't get the Rice Krispies treats to work in a cereal box. So at some point they figured out that they just needed the flavor. And as soon as they got the Krispies treats flavor in there, people were buying the cereal. So I was thinking, actually, just occurred to me that we closed the chapter with this fraudulent research about frosted mini wheats as brain food. And notice that we opened the chapter with claims by Post that grape nuts was brain food. Remember that? So, I mean, I didn't bother covering that first few pages because we've read about the Kellogg and Post Battle Creek story. But it's interesting that we haven't made a whole lot of progress. Eating super sugary food isn't brain food, but it does increase your attentiveness. I mean, you're getting energy. We're going to be talking about carbs today. So it occurred to me that actually, you know, people are talking about being in a post-truth era in politics with all the problems with fake news and all the changes in journalism that have reduced the authoritativeness of journalism. And so the people are using, have you heard this phrase, post-truth? No? Is that coming up? Some of you? No, not so. So some people are saying, well, we're in kind of a post-truth era because the traditional authorities in the culture for regulating truth aren't believed, or they're not doing their job, or we're not following conventions that we used to have in political life about making claims. So I don't know how you want to analyze that, but it just occurred to me that we actually might have crossed that line in the food industry before we did it in politics, because in food, we stopped caring whether something was cereal. You remember that earlier in the chapter, there was that point about how people were saying, well, it's not cereal anymore. And the industry kind of responded and said, well, who cares? Call it whatever you want. So the idea was that we stopped caring about the underlying meanings of the terms in the food that we eat for a variety of reasons, partly because we came to trust industrial food producers to be giving us something that was healthy. Okay, any other thoughts about this chapter? Yeah, I thought it would be good to get you a story about the cereal wars, and this guy tells it pretty well. Okay, let's go ahead and take a look at your carb worksheet, if we could. We'll see what you pulled out of that, and then we'll just kind of walk through the carb chapter and make sure we're pulling out what we need for understanding from that. Oh, right. I get to give you my digression on gene culture coevolution here, too. Okay, yeah. So let's start with them. If you have your worksheet oh, by the way, you should have turned that in then. If you're turning that in for credit, please send it in by, you should send it in by now. So let's work through this one together. And so how are we going to describe carbs chemically? It's almost pretty easy to do from the word. Anybody? Fundamentally, carbs are chemicals made of carbon and hydrogen and oxygen. And what do we want? What do we need to say about the way carbs vary? Somebody take us into this. Has more detail to it, obviously. So there's like two or three points we can pull out of this. How do carbs vary? What did you guys say for that part? You have that? Are all carbs the same? No. Let's start getting into it. You might need a minute to page through the chapter. I hope you brought your chapters with you. Please bring your readings with you.
So there's simple carbs and complex carbs.
Yeah.
And simple carbs have either one or like two sugar units.
Right. Monosaccharides or disaccharides, right?
And then the complex carbs have multiple sugar units.
Yeah, so in a sense, right, for your notes, it's we could say all carbs are sugar, ultimately, right? Because they're all, even though they're complex carbs or starches, they when they're metabolized, they're always broken down into sugars, right? So with carbs, you're always thinking about energy, right? And now, the puzzle here, of course, is that carbs are identified as an energy food, so our dominant metaphor for carbs is energy. But notice that, you know, all of our macronutrients have calories. So in one sense, they all provide energy. And we're not reading the chapter in the book that really goes into this, but there's a really good chapter in this textbook that talks about how proteins, fats, and carbs all, how we get the energy value, the calories, out of all of those. But carbs are primarily energy, and they vary depending upon their complexity in terms of how they're metabolized. And so what's the difference between what's the difference in metabolism between a starchy carb and a simple sugar carb? How does your body experience those two things differently? They're both carbs. They could both have the same amount of calories. What's the difference between a really complex starchy carb in your, how does your body experience that versus a really simple carb? Yeah.
One difference is it has more fiber in it, which your system digests differently and doesn't
eat
as much as fat.
Right. Good. So fiber can slow down the insulin reaction from a carb, right? What else?
Simple sugars don't need to go through digestion.
Right.
It's readily available.
That was an interesting detail from the chapter. Let's make sure you get that in your notes. You don't even digest simple sugars. They're ready to go. They can go right into your bloodstream. So starches require more enzyme action to digest them, and you learn about that in a little bit later in the chapter when you learn about the enzymes that come out of your pancreas and small intestines to digest carbs. I think I took some notes on that. That's actually down with metabolism, yeah. There are some limits, I thought. So our dominant image for carbs so far is that they're sources of energy, and they range from simple sugars to complex starches, and they digest differently based on their complexity and presence of fiber, okay? So that's kind of what we had so far. But the energy metaphor has some limits. I was going through the chapter and thinking about this, and it's important, for instance, to know that carbs are related to our insulin response. We've talked about that a few times. Fiber is not just important for the obvious reasons. Fiber is important because it's important to the microbiome researchers because it seems to relate to useful bacteria production in in your large intestine. Remember, you have just trillions and trillions of bacteria in your intestines, which we used to think didn't do anything for you. But now we're starting to notice all kinds of effects from that microbiota. And so one way to think, and by the way, put this in your notes, carbs are the only food that survives into the large intestine. You don't get much protein or fat in your stools. You know, so it's really about the carbs when it comes down to that neighborhood. And so some people say the way to think about carbs is that you're eating, when you're thinking about your carbs, don't just think about feeding yourself. You're actually feeding trillions. You contain multitudes, as Walt Whitman would have said, right? So think about feeding. You're not just eating for you. There are literally 10 to the 15th number of bacteria per millimeter in your large intestines. It's extraordinary. Zero bacteria in your stomach. If you have bacteria in your stomach, you got a problem. But your intestines are just packed with bacteria. And there's all kinds of interesting things people are finding out about that bacteria. Some of it actually protects us against various kinds of diseases. It's just a really active area. It's a hard thing to study. But the point I would offer is that there are some limits to the energy metaphor because carbs do other things. They like we found out with proteins, you shouldn't just be thinking about your level of carbs as an abstract number. You should be thinking about the quality and types of carbs and where they're going in your body. And when you start to visualize this, you realize that these macronutrients, this is where nutritionism comes in. Remember nutritionism? Nutritionism is about reducing nutrients to just single causes and imagining that, oh, I need the carbs because they're going to give me energy. But it's not quite like that. The carbs, the way you ingest carbs is going to have effects on all kinds of things in your metabolism, and so that's important to keep in mind. For instance, carbs help, your carb levels help tell your body whether it needs to break down protein for energy or fats for energy. And you learned in this chapter that fibers, not all fibers are the same, right? So there's soluble and insoluble fibers, right? Soluble fibers are the ones that we can get more, that have a lower a cholesterol-lowering effect, but they're also, soluble fiber is the stuff that feeds our gut bacteria. I thought one of the shock statistics in the chapter was that high fructose corn syrup has come up from 0.12 teaspoons a day to 11 teaspoons a day. What is that, an order of magnitude, 100? Something like that? And you have a research article here, in case you're curious, about high fructose corn syrup. If you want to dig into some of the mechanisms, this goes beyond our level in the course in general, but many of you have science backgrounds, and I thought you might enjoy that. And I also put up a nutrition diet article. Well, this is the article we actually had from before when we were looking at artificial fiber. Remember that? When we were talking about how there could be a high level of fiber in an industrial breakfast cereal, and we discovered that there was something called isolated fiber, which was a kind of industrial substitute. So the point of bringing that up is to say, and this may be relevant for your notes, is to say that even the quality of the fiber that you're looking at matters. So when you look at fiber on a nutrition label, now you realize, right, that that's not telling you all you need to know. You need to know what type of fiber that is. Is it soluble or insoluble? Is it synthetic fiber? Is it something that an industrialist put in there? Or is it the kind of natural fiber you get from cereals and grains? Okay. Let's see where we are. Are there carbs in milk? Yeah, please, we can back up.
Isn't this like still nutritionalism though? Because it's still breaking it into its component parts.
Yeah, there's this, I think, tell me how you're remembering our discussion of nutritionism, because I remember that there is a fine, that there's a tension between acknowledging the reality of nutrition, which is a product of a reductive science, right? I mean, how did we make progress on nutrition? We did it the way we did make progress on a lot of science. We break problems down into, you know, more analytic problems. I think it's only nutritionism if you ignore the metabolic effects and if you ignore the qualitative differences. So remember with...
Really basic understanding of nutrition.
Yeah, nutritionism can come about in popular imagination, partly when people look at a claim on a package that says, reduced added fiber, and they say, oh, that's got to be good. So, yeah, some nutrition partly is a simplistic thing, but it's also something that Pollan argued experts fell into. Yeah. So it's really when it's reductive and when you're thinking about nutrients as single causes and you're not asking how they interact dynamically. So, yeah, good question, yeah. Are there carbs in milk? What? Lactase is the enzyme to digest it, right? So we tend not to think about there being carbs in milk, so that kind of caught my attention. So soluble and insoluble, we covered that, did we? What is soluble fiber? This is on page 17. This is kind of important. One of the interesting things about soluble fiber is that it holds water. And so when you eat foods that have soluble fiber in them, you feel more full. At a chemical level, soluble fiber can bind bile acids and lower blood cholesterol. But at a behavioral level, having soluble fiber in your food means that it attracts water into the stomach and small intestines. Maybe that's not right, at least into your stomach. And you just have this feeling of being full. So this is a connection between nutrition and satisfaction, right? Okay. There was a controversy about, I'm a little fuzzy on number four. Maybe you guys could help me with this. What's the controversy about net carbs? This was something the food industry wanted to do, right? Could we start by locating that in the where did that come up in the chapter? I forgot. It is close to the end, yeah. It was a text box. Anyway, we'll get it out. 25, thanks. Right, so here it is. Right, when we were all carbophobes, we wanted to lower the reporting of carbs. So the idea was that you could take the portion of the carbs that didn't produce high glycemic index values, that didn't stimulate insulin production, and you could kind of remove those from your report of carbs so that you could under-report the carbs on the package. And there are some criticisms of that. Notice that it's really a way of convincing people that they're getting less carbs than they need when they may actually be quite healthy with those carbs. So it's a kind of a reporting food labeling issue, right? Okay. I don't think we need to get into groups to do this. Were you guys able to do your calculations for carbs? That's pretty straightforward. There's a range. And what was the proportion that should be complex carbs? Anybody find that? Over half, right? Should be complex carbs. Okay. Okay, the last thing I want to get in... Any other comments or questions? Okay, the last thing I want to get into our record today is really kind of a digression from the discussion of lactose and lactase. If you could flip to that with me, it actually raises a really interesting issue about food culture. So this is on page 26, and it's really about this delicate subject of lactose intolerance. And maybe some of you are familiar with this, but this is just an isolated little detail that I'd like to capture here. This is so gene culture coevolution. This will just take a few minutes. Evolution is the concept that this is starting under lactose intolerance. Why are some people lactose intolerant? There might be several reasons, but this is the big reason. Cultures that have dairying tend to produce populations that are 80% lactose tolerant and 20% lactose intolerant. Cultures that don't have a lot of dairying in their history, that is the use of dairy products, the production of dairy products, tend to be the opposite. So they tend to be 20% lactose intolerant. So cultures without dairying tend to be 80% lactose intolerant. Cultures with dairying tend to be 80% lactose tolerant. And the key mechanism here is that after breastfeeding, your body, before agriculture, if you were breastfed, your body would turn off the production of lactase early in your life. So you couldn't digest cow milk. For example, you can still digest cheese and yogurt because they have different amounts of lactase. But here's the main point: when Darien came in, it posed a selection effect that disadvantaged people who couldn't continue to produce lactase. So people who had the variants of the gene that controls lactase production that allowed lactase production to continue had an advantage in terms of survival compared to people who didn't. So the presence of dairying actually had a selection effect, an evolutionary selection effect on human populations. And being able to keep dairy cows through the winter was a huge benefit for humans, right? Because think about it. You've got this animal that you can keep all winter long. It's going to keep producing a great source of protein. All you have to do is put enough silage and grass away to feed it. But the result is that you actually changed the genetic profile of the population. So dairying is considered the textbook case of gene culture coevolution, because our food, it's a case in which our food culture actually created a culturally induced selection effect. Isn't that fascinating? That actually put a selection pressure on people who could continue to produce lactase, so they could continue to benefit from the added protein in their diet. And I guess the reason that, well, there's a lot of reasons why people find this interesting. One reason is that it suggests that our food culture is actually changing us, that food cultures create their own selection effects. So if you happen to come from an ethnicity that is highly sensitive to high refined carb diets, you're going to suffer more from the Western diet. You see where I'm going with this? So the first point for your notes is that culture creates selection. Food cultures create selection effects that advantage or disadvantage people over time, and that's just a fact. I mean, dairying culture was a good thing for humans, but where it occurred, people who didn't produce that lactase had a selective disadvantage. So that's kind of the first effect there. The second point from this is that there might be food justice issues that come out of this. And the example I gave you was the Western diet. The Western diet causes different obesity rates in different ethnicities. So people are selectively disadvantaged by the Western diet depending upon what their food culture of origin was. So I wanted to work that in there because it kind of connects with the lactose intolerance article, the ethnicity and lactose intolerance article, in the chapter. But they missed what I thought was the most interesting part, which is that these intolerances and intolerance come about partly because of a gene culture coevolution, which is a pretty dramatic effect of food culture on human populations. And I guess if we want to draw a third point, tell me what you guys are thinking from this. If we want to draw a third point out of this, it might be that maybe we just need to keep eating an industrial diet and we just kind of see who can survive on it. I mean, it's kind of a brutal way to look at it. I mean, most of the course is oriented the other way, to saying, let's get off the Western diet, let's figure out what a healthy diet would look like. But you could go the other way, and you could say, well, industrial food is here to stay, so, you know, the people who are going to do well on it are the people who are going to survive, and the people who aren't. And that seems like a brutal way to take a lesson about gene culture coevolution. Okay, any thoughts on this? Did we get through our worksheet? Let's go back to our, let's see if there's some notes that we missed here. There are a couple of details here. Let's just take a few minutes and finish this up. I got curious about this, so I wanted to actually show you what glycogen looks like in muscles. Maybe some of you science folks have seen this. But you can actually see glycogen stores in muscles. This is a case of I can't remember what animal this is from. Maybe a rat. No, is it? It's an amoeba. No. That's C. So glycogen, you learn in this chapter that reserve fuel is stored in glycogen. You actually most people have about 1 to 2 hours of glycogen stores in their muscles that they can use. You also store glycogen in your liver, is that right? Let's see, any other details from this? Let's see. Right. Okay, guys. Let's break there, and I'll see you in 2 days, and we'll talk about, we'll make some progress on gastronomy.